March 30th, 2013 in Zagreb, Croatia, meeting with the Aces. Okay, so this is just open. Whatever anybody wants to talk about or not talk about. Do all of you here know English? For now, you all know English, okay. It's interesting how in some countries pretty much everyone knows English and in other countries nobody knows it.
Like in Hungary.
In Hungary, yeah.
They don't know.
Most don't. Probably 80, 90% don't know English. In China, nobody knows English. They can't even say hello.
Really?
Really. They can't even say
hello. How is it in Italy? Do they know English?
Italy, half. In Russia, also, nobody knows English.
In Russia.
So, how may I serve you?
I'm sorry, I didn't prepare anything because I didn't know that it would be like this.
Oh, what did you want?
Maybe some lecturing.
You wanted a lecture.
Just like at least 5-10 minutes, maybe.
You had 5-10 minutes?
At 1 hour.
At 1 hour. Okay, give me a topic. What do you want me to talk about?
What? Children?
Children we're talking about tomorrow. I mean, we could talk about children today, but I'm giving a whole seminar tomorrow.
Really?
That's the plan.
Nobody
knows about it. Okay, well, that's interesting. If nobody knows about it.
I think I just saw it in the morning.
Yesterday it was not.
Yeah, it was.
Okay, let's see what we have here.
I have one.
Okay. So, yes, 11 o'clock tomorrow morning, we're doing something about parenting and children.
I can speak for myself. I'm very sorry that I will not be able to come because it's Easter tomorrow.
Yeah, so you have to go to church.
And what is said that...
No, not my mother.
And the devotee said that today we will have this grihastha.
Yeah, today is grihastha, tomorrow is children.
Today is husband and wife.
Well, grihastha ashram in general.
Husband and
husband. Oh, God, Krishna. I am not giving a seminar on that. May that day never come that I'm asked to give a seminar on that. I will walk out and start my own organization. You can't even say anymore publicly. You can't say it. You can't say anything anymore. Buddy. Isn't it? Nothing. You just have to smile. I mean, on Facebook, so many devotees are supporting. So what topic of household life would you like me to talk about?
I have a question now.
Oh, now you have a question. Before I was just about to gear up for a 5 to 10 minute lecture. Yeah. Now you have a question. Yes.
Just about this, because it's a husband and wife, because lots of devotees getting divorced, and how to support them to try to stay together, and because here in Croatia, lots of devotees separated now. Because they don't have patience, or husband doesn't help me. Husband does not change nappies.
I don't love him anymore, right? Like that.
Yeah.
I'm not attracted to him anymore. I'm bored.
So what's grihastha ashram supposed to be?
Okay, well, grihastha ashram is supposed to be an ashram. It's supposed to be a yagya. It's supposed to be a sacrifice. So I can give you my little lecture now. How's that? Is that all right? Okay. I've really been meditating recently on what Krishna says about sacrifice. In the third chapter of Bhagavad Gita, text 15, it says, Sarvagatam Brahma, Nitya Yagya Pratistitam. That truth is everywhere, right? Krishna is everywhere, yes? Krishna is everywhere, is that true?
Yeah.
Yes? So how are we going to find him? Where are you going to find him if he's everywhere? That was Hiranyakashipu's thing. He's everywhere? Where can I find him? So you can find him in sacrifice. He's eternally situated in sacrifice. And then it's also interesting that Krishna says to Brahma, let's see if I can get this one right because I'm just memorizing it. Tapo ridayam sakshad atmaham tapaso. So tapasya is directly my heart. Tapo ridayam sakshad, Krishna is saying. Tapasya is directly my heart. Atmaham. Aham means I, atma, myself, tapasa. My very self is tapasya. So that's interesting. Krishna says, I create, maintain, and destroy by penance only. So tapasya, penance, usually means you've done something wrong and now you're doing something difficult or painful to compensate for what you've done wrong. Whereas sacrifice, I mean, certainly tapasya is a kind of sacrifice. Penance is a kind of sacrifice. And tapasya may also be, I mean, yagya may also be done to achieve something. I want to get something, therefore I do some sacrifice. So if you want to find the truth, you have to go, if you want to find where's the heart of the truth, where's Krishna's heart, you'll find it in tapasya. Where's Krishna's self? You'll find it in tapasya. If you want to find truth, you'll find it in sacrifice, in yagya. Now, of course, tapasya and yagya have connotations to us of suffering. In fact, the word tapa can mean just suffering. You know, your happiness in life and your tapa in life. But of course, tapasya, we think of austerity, is voluntary difficulty. And yet we know that the absolute truth is joyful. It's full of bliss. So how is it that the absolute truth that's full of bliss is to be found in austerity and penance? Isn't that interesting? And Krishna says in the 18th chapter that even the great souls shouldn't give up austerity, penance, and charity. Charity also we can think of as a kind of pain. Because whatever I have, I want to keep. I don't want to give it away. So charity is I take something valuable that I could use for myself and I give it to somebody else. So that's again a kind of tapasya, a kind of sacrifice. So we meditate, well, what does that mean? And if we think about the Sanatan Dharma, that our Sanatan Dharma is to serve, so that's also a kind of sacrifice. You could say it's a kind of charity. We're giving something. We're sacrificing something. And if we've done something wrong, that sacrifice is also wrapped up with penance. So this is also Krishna's nature. It's not that our nature is to give and his nature is to take. His nature is also to give. Eko bhavanam yo vidadati kaman. Krishna is supplying. I mean, Krishna is the ultimate giver. He's the most charitable. Therefore, you can find Krishna in sacrifice. So the way I understand it is that materialistic mentality, maya, sense gratification, is exactly the opposite. It is taking. It's about me. And materialistic mentality is even, you can suffer for me. You can do penance for me. You can do sacrifice for me. You can give charity to me. And I will be the taker. In this way, we try to imitate Krishna. Because Krishna is, in one sense, the taker. Bhakti ramya gatapasam sarvalokamahesham. Bhakti ramya gatapasam. Yagya tapasam. Sacrifice and penance. Bhoktiram, I'm the one who enjoys your sacrifice and penance. So we can say that Krishna is the taker, but he's also the giver. And Krishna gives far more than he takes. I mean, if I give Krishna sacrifice and penance, what can I give him? Not much. Even if I give him everything, what is my everything? It's not much. Whereas if Krishna gives me everything, if I give Krishna everything I have, and Krishna in return gives me everything he has, I get the far better end of the deal. He's much more a giver. So materialistic mentality is I want to try to be God by basically just being a taker. And therefore, dharma, even material dharma, involves sacrifice, penance, and charity. That's what it's about. Even if you want karmakanda, even if you want to be happy in the world. And by the way, you can be happy in the world from a particular perspective. And you can't get unlimited ecstasy from material things. But you can have a comfortable material situation. I mean, the demigods have a relatively comfortable material situation. And even if you want that, you have to engage in sacrifice, austerity, penance, charity. And so all the varnas and the ashrams, which are the how mundane dharma is understood, is meant to have certain kinds of sacrifice, penance, and charity. Now, in the Kali Yuga, where our mood is, I don't want to do any sacrifice, penance, and charity. I just want to take. I mean, why are we destroying the earth? Is there a problem?
One word.
Uh-huh. We just want to take from the earth. We don't want to take care of the earth. We don't want to, or the animals. You know, if you think about the meat industry, they just want to take as much as they can from the animals to give the cow chemicals so that she'll give as much milk as possible. And as soon as the milk supply drops a little bit, she's still giving milk, but it's just dropped a little bit. Then kill her. You know, the chickens, they keep them in the dark because they get fatter faster if they're in the dark. And they, you know, again, they feed them chemicals and hormones. And this, they get so fat they can't move. And I mean, they don't even take minimal care of these creatures. Not even the most basic care. Just taking. So this is a society in which we're all living. You know, even if we come to the Hare Krishna movement, we're still very affected by this society, which is that happiness is to be found in taking. Do as little sacrifice, penance, and charity as you can possibly get away with. Now, of course, it's a bunch of lies that will bring you happiness. It's just a lie. Maya means something that's false, something that's a lie. That what it really is and what it pretends to be are different. So especially now in Kali Yuga, this idea of lying and cheating and pretense is very, very high. But this is how we're really indoctrinated, that happiness is to be found in taking, and then we're miserable. So the Grihastha ashram is a particular kind of sacrifice, penance, and charity. Each of the ashrams, each of the varnas, has its particular kind of sacrifice, penance, and charity. And each has its particular kind of enjoyment also. So each ashram is, okay, how do I want to enjoy? One has to be very honest. And then to make it an ashram, it's what sacrifice do I do that will give me the right to get that particular kind of enjoyment. Now, if you just think like that, that's karmakanda. But it's a lot better than vikarma, which is stealing. So when people get divorced, generally, I mean, there are some genuine reasons for divorce. You know, if your spouse is violent and hurting you, you know, molesting your children, I mean, you know, having affairs with 40 other people, you know, there are genuine reasons to separate at least. And even in Vedic times, sometimes a husband and wife would separate. I mean, there are there are have always been reasons why separation is required. I mean, the only reasons for divorce is to remarry, that I can understand. Or maybe if the country wouldn't give you proper legal protection unless you were divorced, that might be the case in some countries, that if your spouse is threatening to kill you, if you're just separated, the government might not protect you. So there might be some reasons, but generally, unless you want to marry again. And at least according to the Vedic standard, one marriage means one marriage for life. The Vedic idea of monogamy is one partner per life, for the man also. Like Lord Ramachandra took this vow, Ekapatni Vrata, one wife vow. That meant one wife for life. It didn't mean one wife at a time. So even when Sita was in the forest, he didn't marry again. Even when Sita went into the earth, when by ordinary understanding she died, of course Sita doesn't die, but he didn't marry again because he'd taken a vow, only one wife. So the concept of having one spouse after another is not there. It could be there for a man if he hasn't taken that kind of a vow. But if his wife dies, he can marry again. Of course, for the men, they can also marry more than one woman at a time. But this idea that this is a sacrifice, it's a penance also. We're in this body because we've committed a crime against the Lord. We've committed a crime against ourselves. And therefore, we're doing a sacrifice and a penance and a charity. So people generally get divorced, not because the other partner is violent or because something like that, but because they feel, I'm not getting enough of what I want. I'm not happy. So this is misunderstanding where happiness comes from. Happiness does not come from a comfortable, pleasing, external environment. It just doesn't. That's not a source of happiness. Happiness comes from sacrifice and penance and charity. And when done for the sake of Krishna, then that gives spiritual happiness. But even material happiness comes from sacrifice, penance, and charity.
Hare Krishna?
Yes, Hare Krishna.
Devotees from the kitchen asked to have microphones.
So oh, sure, that's fine. So most of the time when people get divorced, one of the people or both of the people don't understand this idea. And this is true in all ashrams. It's not that if you're in a renounced ashram, there's no sacrifice, penance, and charity. It's just a different kind. And it's not that if you find a new partner, there'll be no sacrifice, penance, and charity. This is ridiculous. Of course, the secret is that when you do the appropriate sacrifice, penance, and charity as an offering to Krishna, because Krishna's heart is in penance, because Krishna's self is in penance, because you find the truth in austerity, when you do it in the proper consciousness, what do you find? Krishna's full of bliss. This is the irony. You know, so since it's Easter tomorrow, we can also say, Jesus said, those who seek to find their life will lose it, and those who lose their life for my sake will find it. Things are opposite to what we think in a conditioned state. In a conditioned state, we think, let me take as little austerity as possible, and then I will enjoy. But the reality is that if I do sacrifice and austerity for Krishna, then I will enjoy. That's the reality. If we try to be takers, we won't enjoy even our enjoyment.
Do you need a song in the temple?
No.
No, it's okay.
No.
Okay.
And we've experienced this. You know, if I think, okay, I'm just going to enjoy without sacrifice, my enjoyment turns into a sacrifice. My pleasure becomes miserable. If I sacrifice as a materialist, then at least I get to enjoy my pleasure because I've paid for it. but my sacrifice is still sacrifice. And if I sacrifice for Krishna, then everything merges into transcendence. I get actual enjoyment, and my sacrifice becomes enjoyment. This is really, really basic. This is Bhagavad Gita 3, 4, and 5. Very, very, very basic Krishna conscious philosophy. You know, and once we understand that, then we can talk about specifics, how a man should deal with his wife, how a wife should deal with her husband. But the basic point, we have to grasp this basic point. That joy is found in penance, austerity, and charity when done for Krishna. That's where we find joy. We do not find joy in avoiding those things and just trying to take the pleasure. Avoiding those things and just trying to take the pleasure is stealing. I don't want to pay. I just want to take. A stealing is not very pleasurable, is it? You can't really enjoy stolen things. I mean, there's some sort of pleasure in the concept that I've done something evil and gotten away with it. But there's not really any joy in it. So for most people, in their prime of life, in the main portion of life, age 15 or 20 to 50, 55, the main sacrifice, penance, and charity one does is the grihastha ashram. That's going to be true, or should be true, for the majority of people. And as so many people now are dying in their 50s, 60s, 70s, that's going to be the bulk of life. So that concept has to be accepted first before you can talk about details. If someone's thinking, well, you know, how can I treat my husband so he'll deal with me the way I want? Or how can I treat my wife so she'll deal with me the way I want? Then you're kind of missing the point. Now, on a detailed level, Prabhupada said that people shouldn't get married unless they have education and counseling beforehand. So in North America, the Grihastha Vision team has put together a course, a 4 or 5 day course for people who plan to get married or people who are already married. And then they've set up a system to train mentor couples in a community, especially to help a married couple in their first year of marriage. So I'd say on a specific individual level, that's very important. People should get training before they get married. That was Prabhupada's direct instruction. And some kind of mentoring while married, and there should be some sort of help in the community. And this help should be given before it becomes a crisis and a catastrophe. So there's one couple I know that looks like they're getting divorced. And when I was talking to the husband, he said, well, we went to a devotee counselor who asked my wife, how sure are you you want to get a divorce on a scale of 1 to 10, with 10 being the most sure? She said 10. You know, do you have any desire to work on this relationship? 0. So, you know, once things get to that point, it's very hard to fix them. If someone says, I absolutely want out of this relationship and I'm not willing to do anything to fix it, it's very, how do you help somebody like that? So we should help people before it gets to that point. Another thing we have to understand is marriage isn't going to make us happy. Nothing material is going to make you happy. Being renounced isn't going to make you happy either. Krishna is going to make you happy. You know, this idea that it's my husband or wife who's going to make me happy, or my children who's going to make me happy, or my house who's going to make me happy. Again, this is just very beginning, elementary Krishna consciousness. This is not some advanced Paramahamsa, you know, Rasika, Gopi Bhava. This is just Krishna consciousness 101. We're not going to become happy by a material arrangement. So we're not going to become happy by a material arrangement. We're not going to become happy by a material arrangement. We're going to become happy by our Krishna consciousness. Of course, then somebody might say, well, the reason I can't be Krishna consciousness is my spouse. My wife is preventing me from being Krishna conscious. My husband is preventing me from Krishna consciousness. Of course, that is very rarely true on any level. It's rare that, you know, if you start chanting, your wife will start beating you. That's pretty unusual. But if you say, I want to go to the temple, she'll take away the car keys. She'll burn all your bhagavatams. I mean, there are marriages where that happens, but that's pretty unusual. So really, Krishna consciousness is a hoitukiya pratyata. It's not dependent on our material circumstances. Otherwise, how could those Soviet devotees have been Krishna conscious in labor camps in Siberia? Nobody was helping them be Krishna conscious. Everybody was trying to stop them be Krishna conscious. They were actually beaten if they were chanting. They didn't have any prasadam, they didn't have any deities, they didn't have any books, they didn't have any temple, they didn't have any devotee association. And still they were Krishna conscious. So one can be Krishna conscious in any circumstance, and marriage is not going to make us happy. It's just not. Krishna consciousness will make us happy. Marriage is a particular form of sacrifice, penance, and austerity that's appropriate for the majority of people in their youthful life. And the renounced ashram is a particular form of sacrifice, penance, and austerity that's appropriate for people when they're children and when they're retired. So to first get that, and that we shouldn't think of sacrifice, penance, and charity as scary, because that's Krishna's heart. That's the heart of the supremely blissful, playful, youthful person. And that is the mystery. That we can find bliss in sacrifice, penance, and charity when done for the right person in the right consciousness. That means I don't sacrifice for my husband, I sacrifice for Krishna. It may look the same. Someone is seeing that I'm trying to please my husband. I'm cooking nicely and cleaning the house and smiling at him and telling him how smart he is and so forth. And somebody may say, oh, you're trying to please your husband. But if the person is thinking, I'm doing this so Krishna will be pleased, that's a very different mentality. And that gives you freedom. Because sometimes the husband will be pleased and sometimes the husband will not be pleased. Sometimes the wife will be pleased and sometimes the wife will not be pleased. By the same thing, you can give your wife flowers on Monday and she will say, oh, you're such a wonderful husband. And you give her flowers on Tuesday and she'll say, you think if you give me flowers every day that that'll like solve all of our problems? Right? Or you make lasagna on Monday and your husband says, oh, I love lasagna, and you make it on Tuesday and he says, 2 days in a row, make lasagna. So if we're working to please the husband or please the wife, then we'll be disappointed so many times. But if we're working to please Krishna, then we're free. And then we can experience happiness at any time. So this is a simple formula. And then you can talk about details. What is the psychology of a man? What is the psychology of a woman? What is the way that we try to please Krishna in household life? But if, at least for us to get this concept, that the reason that I'm in householder life is because this is the appropriate sacrifice, penance, and charity for me at this stage. And I will be happy by doing that for Krishna. I will not be happy by householder life in and of itself. If I use my car for Krishna, I'll feel happy. My car will not make me happy. It might give me a little thrill for a little while sometimes. When I first get it, you know, oh, my nice car. But I will only really get happy when I use it for Krishna. So is that all right for my little lecture on household life? So any specific discussions?
question when I saw the seminars.
Okay.
So is it okay?
You can ask whatever you like, sure.
So the title was Transmitting the Culture of Krishna Consciousness to the Next Generation.
Yes.
And then you were saying in a little description, what's the four most important elements and practices to inculcate someone with culture and behavior? And then you say setting a good example is not enough and may even be counterproductive unless these three elements are present. The seminar defines many practical applications. So I'm a little interested, what are these three elements? That
it's four things. Well, then I have to have to do the seminar. Yeah. I don't tell you without doing the seminar.
Yeah. Okay. I tried.
It was really funny. I was giving this seminar. Oh, goodness, where was it? I go so many places, I can't remember where I was anymore. I was somewhere. Johannesburg. And that one of the leaders must have sent me 5 or 6 emails. So what are the four things? I said, I'll tell you in the seminar. He said, but we want to put them in our advertisement. I said, no, that's not what you do. So, yeah, they were trying to decide if they wanted me to do that seminar or sadhana for parenting. So they decided they wanted me to do sadhana for parenting. But I gave Sundarananda the handouts for both. So. I have that in this kind of desire too, so you can listen to this in a minute too. I'm pretty sure we just uploaded a new version of that. Anything else? Surely this is not all the grahasthas in the community here.
No.
Not even 10%.
Yeah. Anything else anybody wants to discuss? So I gave the little lecture and you were gone you left when I started and you came back when I ended.
Unfortunately, my husband is recording.
Okay, but that's funny. You asked me to give a lecture and as soon as I started, you left. And as soon as I ended, you came back.
She can ask the question.
That was very funny. So yes, what was your question? Well, I actually basically tried to answer your question.
And I heard now you were saying about sadhana. Was that in your lecture also?
No, we have a seminar tomorrow at 11 o'clock about sadhana for parents. Yes.
Can I ask you one thing? When parents are bringing the children in the Krishna consciousness, what is the better option? To be very strict with that, only rules, regulations, you should not do this, you should do this, really, like we are in Vedic culture, bring them totally like that. Or, to be a little more flexible because they are in this world today and there is no education, there is no, they will be with their children sooner or later. So my question is it, good to be so strict?
I don't exactly know what you mean by strict. The word strict could have at least 20 different understandings. What exactly do you mean?
I mean, you should not eat this candy, you should not eat this, this is not good, watching television. I understand benedictions of that, but if I'm asking because maybe they will be, put in, some, it's hard to express myself in English. And when they see their friends, who are very loose, they want to become like that, and they just, rebel totally and go in the other side. This is my question. So what should
Being very strict about those things or being not very strict about those things does not seem to be the key to whether or not the children want to be devotees. That doesn't seem to be the indicator.
Okay,
it doesn't, when you look at children when they grow up and see when they say, I really want to be a devotee of Krishna, and you look at their upbringing, you don't usually see a pattern that the people who are more lenient or the people who are very lenient or the people who are very strict or a particular place on the strict lenient scale was what made the difference. That does not seem to be the determining factor.
But at least we tried. If my son decides that he doesn't want to be devoted, I won't let that for now 18 years that, okay, maybe he won't be a devotee, maybe he would, so I won't do nothing.
But my point is that seems to be, if you say, okay, I'm only going to expose my child to Krishna consciousness, or I'm just going to let them do everything, that doesn't seem to be the main thing that determines whether or not they want to be a devotee. It seems to be other things that are much more important than that. That does not seem to be the most important thing. So my own, but you have to remember you're asking me. Okay, you're not asking somebody else, you're asking me. And I'm a very conservative. I'm not all the way on the right. The people all the way on the right think I'm a liberal. Which I always find very humorous. But I'm very far to the right. So you're really getting my opinion. So you have to take it that way. So my own opinion is give them as much Krishna consciousness as possible. What is the? I don't, because this isn't the main thing that makes a difference. What is the reason to compromise? If we saw that people who compromise their children were more likely to be Krishna conscious, but that's not true. So what do I see as the benefits of giving them as much Krishna consciousness as possible? Well, then they have it. You know, once you become an adult, it's hard to find the time to really study Srila Prabhupada's books and learn all the prayers. And, you know, in my school, by the time the children graduated from school, they had read, they knew all the stories in Chaitanya Charitamrita, all the stories in the Bhagavatam, they'd read all of Krishna book, they'd read all of Leelamrita, they had their Bhakti Shastri degree. They'd observed all the festivals, they knew all the prayers, they knew at least 100 slokas. So then they have it. You know, for an adult to do that, then they have to take off, you know, a year of their life and go to India. So why not give my children that gift? Why deprive them of that gift when they're young? I mean, I meet some children, they're 14, and they don't even know what's Brahman, Paramatma, and Bhagavan.
You want the children?
Yeah. Really? Well, if they never go to temple Bhagavatam classes, if they're never listening to Prabhupada's lectures recording, if they're not reading Srila Prabhupada's books, how will they know these things? They're not going to know them. So they don't even know, you know, theoretical philosophy. So I've met many devotee kids like that. Basically what they know is we're supposed to be vegetarian and God is a person and we're not this body. And maybe they know a few stories. And nowadays, you don't even know what stories they're going to know because we've been so infiltrated by Hinduization. So instead of knowing the stories from Prabhupada's books, they may be knowing some other versions of the stories that they got from watching some movie or reading an Indian comic book. And they'll tell you stories of Krishna's pastimes that you're thinking, where's this from? So from my perspective, you know, if I'm born in devotee family next life, I'd like to know all this stuff. I don't want my knowledge of Krishna to come from Amar Chitrakata and Hindu movies. And so I see a lot of devotee kids, they know more about Spider-Man and Batman than they know about Krishna and Ramchandra. Then what is the value of taking birth in a family of devotees? And what's the value? Why bother? But that's, again, my perspective. Other people may have another perspective. And if they haven't had any spiritual experiences, you know, if you don't engage your children in kirtan and japa and deity worship, and then how are they going to get experiences of bliss and realization? Where will they get it from? Then Krishna consciousness will just, then at best it'll be their religion. Pratyaksha bhagavam dharma. Krishna consciousness should be experienced. But the only way you're going to experience it is you have to have opportunities to experience it. If whenever there's a class, the children are playing someplace else, and they're just playing with Superman things, and they're never in the kirtan, and they're never in the class, and where will they get the experience? So where will they get the theoretical knowledge, and where will they get the experience? And then if they do want to be devotees when they're older, I mean, I have no one woman, she's in her 30s, whose parents are devotees, but they didn't teach her anything about Krishna or give her any experience about Krishna when she was growing up. You know, now she's married with 2 children, and one of the things is she really wants her children to learn about Krishna. So I see from that perspective, you know, to know the basic philosophy and tenets of Krishna consciousness and to have opportunities for experience. Now, on the other hand, when it comes to culture, so I separate those two things. I separate the bhakti from the culture. So we are practicing bhakti, but we're practicing bhakti. We have a lot of the trappings of Indian culture. Now that is going to be a problem for our children who aren't growing up in India. If our children are only exposed to Indian food and Indian dress and Indian culture, it's going to be difficult for them to function in a different culture. And this is true even for our children who are being raised in India, but who have a high chance of living as adults out of India. So I would say that it's very important, having talked to hundreds and hundreds of kids born in the movement, that it is very important that children get some practice in dealing with the cultures in which they are likely to live as adults. They should know how to talk to people. I mean, for example, in Croatia, men and women talk to each other. I was just reading what Prabhupada said, that to try to have total separation of men and women, even in India, is some sort of fanatic utopia. You know, if we bring up our children where the boys never ever see a girl and the girls never ever see a boy, they're going to be crippled when they're adults. I mean, they're really going to be crippled. And if you talk to children who were raised like that, they tell you it's crippling for them. Unless they're going to take sannyas when they're 25, which the GBC won't even allow anymore. You know, and live in some Himalayan cave. But if they have to go to this shop and then there's some woman behind the counter and you got to talk to her. And there's some man selling you an airline ticket and you have to talk to him. And you have to see a doctor. And you, I mean, you have to be able to deal with the society. So I see that as absolutely crucial. In the early days of ISKCON, we sequestered our children. We put them in a bubble where they had basically no dealings with the outside world at all. Nothing, except for going out on Harinam book distribution. Otherwise, they never talked to anybody who wasn't a devotee. They didn't have any dealings. They hardly had any dealings with their own parents who were devotees. You know, Rindasru talked about how when he put his daughter in the ashram, he could only see her once a year on Janmashtami. He was allowed to call her once a month. So you had children who didn't, you know, they had no experience of a family. They had no understanding of family relationships. And they had no understanding how to deal in the world. So I still see devotees who think that this is a good idea. There are certainly still devotees who think that the way to raise your children is to have them in complete isolation from everything in the world. But I see the result of that is the children, when they grow up, unless they live in a devotee community where they never have to go outside. I mean, maybe if they grow up and live in Mayapur and they never leave the compound and they never buy a ticket and they never go shopping. But otherwise, if that's not going to be their life, then they become very angry that we crippled them, because we know how to deal with the world. We know how to deal with the world just fine. So that's something that I see as important. But I don't see that as a question of being not strict. Yes?
Excuse me, can someone translate to us some devotee can
thank you. Yes.
From where this idea comes that Guru Kula should be like that?
But you have to remember, when Guru Kula was like that, the culture inside the Guru Kula and the culture outside the Guru Kula was the same. When Krishna went to school and he lived with his teacher, the culture inside his school and the culture outside his school was the same. He wasn't being isolated. They weren't being isolated from the culture. Just like even today, especially very rich people send their children to boarding school. But the culture inside the boarding school and the culture outside the boarding school is the same. It's not a different culture. If you're a very wealthy British royalty and you send your children to a British boarding school, British culture is inside the boarding school and British culture is outside the boarding school.
What is the boarding?
Whether you live there.
Institute.
Where the children live at the school.
Internat, like.
That's not the case anymore. If we send our children, if we put our children in a place where they're only exposed to devotees, but that's not the society, then what we've done is we've crippled their ability to deal with society in general, even as a preacher.
The same principle applies also on the curriculum, no? Like, when I spent time in India, there was they were telling that this school in the Bombay was not really a school like Prabhupada wanted, because they teach some other things, not some spiritual things only. So we have also in Mayapur now, there are few schools there. Bhaktivedya Purnamaraj, like, pure Gurukul, and then you have some schools which are much more in contact with the outer world.
Well, first of all, what is a Gurukula? Prabhupada says in the second canto, Gurukula is supposed to give you specific training for a livelihood. And if you look at a pure Gurukula, I don't see any pure Gurukulas in the world. I don't see any. When Krishna went to Gurukula, he was learning civil engineering. He was learning how to build bridges. He was learning how to dye hair. He was learning how to make airplanes. So please show me the school where the children are learning how to make airplanes. So whenever anybody says to me, we have a real Gurukula, I mean, I don't necessarily say something. But in the real Gurukula, that's what they learned. If you wanted to say what Prabhupada wanted, so far nobody has really done a thorough study of what Prabhupada said about education. You can't translate simultaneously, can you?
They asked me only to translate to them, and they don't understand something.
Okay.
So they just look at me and then I tell them. I always wanted to translate everything, but they told me, no problem,
Okay. I was wondering if I was just losing you, because I've slowed my rate, my speaking rate to half. I'm practically falling asleep while I'm speaking. I'm speaking so slowly. And if we look at Lord Chaitanya's school, Lord Chaitanya was a teacher. He ran a school. It was a day school. Children were not living there. And he was teaching logic and rhetoric and so many things, practical things. Srila Prabhupada in 1976 in Mumbai gave a series of lectures about Gurukula. And I would wish that when people talk about what is a real Gurukula, they would refer to those lectures. Prabhupada says that he's also talking about the Brahmacharya Ashram. And he's again talking about this specific training for a livelihood, because the idea is you leave the Brahmacharya Ashram, you leave the Gurukula, and you get married and you get a job. You have an occupation. So Gurukula is preparing you for an occupation. The Prabhupada said the Brahmachari should know something of everything and everything of something. Something of everything and everything of something. So if that's Prabhupada's instructions, that they should know something of everything, then guess what? They should know something of everything. And if somebody says we have a real Gurukula, then they should be teaching something of everything and everything of something. And if they're not doing that, I beg to differ that it's not a real Gurukula, it's something, whatever it is, but... Prabhupada wanted the devotees to be able to go someplace, open a temple, do all the legal... And he said, I want the devotees to be trained to be generalists, and also to have some specific area of expertise. And as far as curriculum, Prabhupada said different things in different circumstances. So sometimes he says we can use the regular accredited curriculum as long as we make it Krishna conscious. I mean, I visited even, you know, non-ISKCON schools that claim to be authentic Gurukula. I don't see anything that's an authentic Gurukula like Krishna and Balaram went to. I don't think it exists on the planet.
You refer to Avanti schools?
You're
referring to Avanti schools like that they have now in UK?
No, I wasn't referring to them. I said even in India. Non-ISKCON, I have seen in India, like in South India, they will say this is an authentic Gurukula.
Okay.
But they are not teaching what Sandipani Muni taught.
Yeah, also mostly what I've seen was just spiritual, like learning some mantras, doing some yagyas.
Which is very nice.
But after that, if you want to marry, then you...
But the Brahmacharya Ashram is supposed to prepare, most of the Brahmacharyas will marry. And it's supposed to prepare you. Prabhupada said, I'm not saying, he said, specific training for a livelihood. So the idea is when you leave the Brahmacharya Ashram, when you leave the Gurukula, that you have a way of living in the world. And if you're going to become a vanaprastha, because you're not supposed to stay in the Brahmacharya Ashram whole life. You can stay a Brahmacharya whole life, but you're not supposed to stay in the Brahmacharya Ashram whole life. That's for children. So when you leave the Brahmacharya Ashram, when you leave the Gurukula, you should be prepared to marry and maintain a family, or you should be prepared to be a preacher and a renunciate. So you should be prepared for those things. But the concept of separating our children 100% from the culture in which they will live is very foolish. Just like in the military, if they're going to train soldiers, they train them on terrain that is going to be similar to the place where they will fight. That's just good common sense. If you're going to train a doctor, you're going to train them in circumstances similar to those in which they will actually work. If you're going to train a pilot, you train them on an airplane simulator. You do not train somebody for a life in a circumstance that's radically different from the circumstances in which they're actually going to live. That it just doesn't make any sense whatsoever. It's illogical, and on the practical level, the results are not good at all. The children just become angry and bitter that they don't have the skills to negotiate in the world. And we do. So the adults who were raised in that society, we know how to talk to people, and we know how to deal with people, and we know how to interact with people, and they don't. It's like they've been parachuted into another planet. But I do not see that you have to be lenient with the practice of Krishna consciousness to give them that training. It's not that to be able to function in modern society, just like I can function in modern society, but I don't have to know what the latest television shows are and who the latest movie star. I mean, everybody knows a little bit, you know. If you're just living and breathing in the world, you know, you can't miss it, you know something. You know a few names here and there. But, you know, I don't have to know all of those details in order to function in the world. I do have to know something about news. Yes?
So my eldest son is 5 and a half.
Okay.
And what should be your advice maybe for school? There are some options now in Croatia that you can even homeschool your children.
Oh, that's a very...
Not yet.
Yes, it is there something that you can admit him in somewhere in America. They have some Christian schools.
Uh-huh.
And they will send you some papers and then you can legalize it in Croatia also.
Very nice. Of course, homeschool... You know, again, go back to the beginning that you always have to sacrifice. So if you take that as must... There's no alternative in life that you don't sacrifice. So homeschooling is a particular kind of sacrifice. If you send your children to the non-devotee school, that will be another kind of sacrifice. Now, homeschooling is definitely requires a lot of thought and care from the parents. It's not a small thing. My own experience is that homeschooled children have very high character. And it's very easy to give them a first-class education at home. Most schools in the world are not giving such a good education. To compete with them, to be as good as them, or to be better than them is not very difficult. Oh, thank you. The actual amount of education that happens in a school is only like 2, maybe 3 hours a day. The children may be in school for 6 hours a day, but there's not 6 hours of learning happening. It's mostly wasted time. So you can teach everything they teach in the school in 2, maybe 3 hours a day. I read about one family, Christian family. They had 10 children. They had 2 hours of school a day, and all of their children got master's degrees by the time they were either 16 or 18 years old. If you have a job, that's a little difficult.
To maintain all family.
I don't think if both husband and wife work, you can do homeschooling. Maybe, but I don't know. I don't know how you would do it. Maybe it's possible. I'm not going to say it's impossible, but I will say I don't know how to do that. I'm not saying it's impossible. I mean, if the wife had a job she could do from home, or she worked part-time, or the husband worked part-time, but it seems somebody would have to work part-time or work from home. If both people have full-time jobs where they're leaving the house, I don't think you would have the energy. And then all your teaching would have to be at night, which is not the best time. For you or the child. or on the weekend. I mean, perhaps it's possible, but I'd have to see a model. I'm not saying it's not possible.
I have a question in this topic. I'm a teacher in a Waldorf school,
okay.
Music teacher, and in this school here we have like 10 children, 14 in one
okay.
Classroom, and I somehow noticing that the children are very much learning by themselves, just inspiring, and actually they are very inspiring when they see that somebody like them, which is on their level, know the things, know much more something than they know. You know, and somehow I'm getting some realization that if there are maybe 20, 25 children, sometimes then it is easier to teach.
In many ways, yes, that is true.
And it is really a great potential that comes from them.
That is, there is truth in it.
Because sometimes when some children are ill, we have maybe 5 children in a room. And if there are children with small capacities and one children with very big capacities, actually, all the time you see that this child with great capacities can reach much more if there are maybe 5 or 6 children with the same level of capacities. Like when I was in my school, we were 13 in one. And what do you think about that? Just
well, that, if I understand you correctly, then that was how I taught. I had all different abilities and ages in one room. You mean like that?
No, because I'm a little bit... one question is coming from... what about when I have 2 children at home and I'm just learning them all the time?
Okay.
They will definitely get something. Maybe they can become perfect, I don't know. But what about their experience in dealing when they are...
other children?
Peers.
So then you have to make some arrangement for that. Again, there's always a sacrifice. So if you send your children to a non-devotee school, then... first of all, they're going to be learning some bad habits for sure, 100%. They may learn some bad habits from other devotee children also. But definitely, for the non-devotee children, they'll be learning some bad habits. So you'll have to spend some time unteaching things. And then the school will not be teaching Chaitanya Charitamrita and Bhagavad Gita, so you're going to have to spend time adding that. If you teach at home, you're going to have to spend some time adding the social aspect. And if you start your own school, then that's another kind of yajna. You know, it's... choose your yajna is what it comes down to. You have to say, which sacrifice am I comfortable with making? The problem is, if we look at homeschooling and say, oh, this is missing. But in every situation, something is missing. It's always like that. Just like we're talking about household life. In household life, the main thing that's missing is freedom. In the renounced ashram, the main things that are missing are security, mostly security, control. Every place has something that's missing. I mean, even if you have a devotee school, and even if the devotee school is very individually tailored, it can never be as individually tailored as a homeschool. A homeschool can be 100% individually tailored as far as the time, the schedule, the learning method. Homeschool can be very much about real life learning. There's no school that can do real life learning as much as a homeschool. You just can't. But in a homeschool, what you're missing are many other children at the same level. You can't do a lot of group work. You can't do sports. You know, even if you have 10 children, they're going to be different ages. One child's going to be 16 and one child's going to be 6 months. It's not like you can, you know, make a baseball team, even if you have 9 children. You understand? So it's... and if you have the non-devotee school, then what's missing is, you know, so many things. You're missing the learning the shastra, learning the slokas, learning the philosophy. You're missing the spiritual culture. You're missing even the prasadam. I mean, you know, whatever situation you pick, there's something missing. So whatever you pick, you have to add that separately. So even if your children go to a devotee school, you're going to have to add real life practical application of Krishna consciousness. And if they're homeschooled, then you have to add the social development. You have to have activities with them outside the school, outside your home, with other children. But you will not find a situation where you get everything. It just doesn't work like that. You can get everything in the sense internally, you can get everything from Krishna, but as far as externally, it's not going to happen. So the main advantages of homeschooling is flexibility and individualization and real lifeness. That's not a real English word. I don't know if you can translate it. That you can make school like life. You can make learning real. You know, in every school we just give the children artificial projects, basically. That you just, the parents look at and then they go in the, goes in the rubbish. But you can do some real life things in a school, but it's much easier to do it. Yeah.
I have a question.
Yes.
How, but you were saying that in homeschooling, it's a problem that they don't, you know, that they don't have these group sports or something like
yes.
that. What do you think about, you know, sending, teaching children at home and also sending them to sports?
So of course.
That's
exactly.
You bet.
Exactly. That's exactly what you do. And if you can make some events with the other devotee children also, that's very good. But you want your children to have some experience dealing with non-devotees. You don't want them to become 20 years old and they've never talked to a non-devotee in their life. That's not a very good idea. They have to know how to make phone calls, they have to know how to go to stores and buy things and interact with people, and they have to understand how people talk and what they're talking about. I mean, you don't have to. Otherwise, you're turning your child into a Martian. You understand? And then all of a sudden they're in the, what alien landscape am I in? But it's also nice if you can have events with other children. So my daughter-in-law homeschools her children, and once a week they get together with other families who are also homeschooling, and they have some activities together. They have some sports together, they have some classes together, and some of the adults in the community come and teach classes on shastra and philosophy and different specialties, music, and things that the parents can't do themselves. And then you remember last year I brought my grandson with me? You remember? Yeah. So he's homeschooled. So because he's homeschooled, I could take him traveling for 7 months. He said everybody would ask him, don't you need to go to school? How can you travel with your grandma for 7 months? He says, oh, I'm homeschooled. And he was homeschooled also, he was 2 years ahead in his studies.
Two years ahead.
Because when you're homeschooled, you can do that easily. So what's a better education, sitting in a classroom or traveling around the world? Right? So when you're homeschooled, you can do that kind of thing. You can take your children to India for a month. You know? And you can make it part of their education. I mean, I had him, he had to write a paper on every country. You had to do research and write a paper in every country. It gives you that. You can't do that in a regular school. It's not possible. Yes?
When to start thinking what is the occupation from a child? Because for my sake, I... 23, I realized that I should teach. And I started teaching what I like at 45. Wow. 44 last year.
So I recently met.
I was aware what to do, but somehow, you know, because you always do the needful or some other things, and then you end up almost at the end of your life.
I learned that I was a teacher when I was 24. And that was because of association that I met one devotee, Jojo Mai, who trained me how to teach. And once I learned how to teach, then I realized that I really enjoyed it. Ideally, somewhere around 12, 14, maybe 16 years old, ideally, at least in a general way. And usually it's obvious. If somebody's paying attention. I mean, one way is you take the children and you engage them in a number of different real activities, starting from when they're young. Give them an opportunity. I mean, I just didn't have that opportunity until I was 24.
Yeah.
As soon as I was in the right place with the right person, it came out. But until I was in the right place with the right person, I didn't know it was there. I just didn't know it was there. I had no idea. And if you would have told me, I would have said, no, 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 it's not what I want to do. Yes.
Oh, I would like also to ask something regarding the engagement of our children in the future, in the movement.
Mm.
Because I spoke with one devotee who is a son of a proper disciple,
mm-hmm.
and I asked him, what was the reason that you stayed in Krishna consciousness?
Mm-hmm.
And he said he stayed engaged in Krishna consciousness. He is an artist. And he was engaged among the devotees in art.
So that's one of the four things.
Okay. So we found one.
To have meaningful, valuable, practical engagement in Krishna consciousness. All of us, every living entity wants to do something that's meaningful and appreciated and valuable. And part of that is, part of it is something that's needed, like you said, do the needful. Some of it, part of it is something that's needed, and part of that is something that is that I can uniquely offer. Something that's needed by others, and something that I have a talent for. If it's needed by others, but I just do it terribly and I hate it, that doesn't feel very valuable to me. And if it's something that I really enjoy and nobody else cares, I mean, that may be a hobby that I'm just doing for myself. But if it's something that, you know, that I really enjoy doing and I'm good at, and other people also need and appreciate. So you want to get your children involved in doing things like that as early as possible. 4 or 5 years old is not too early. I'd say 14 is the absolute latest. 10, 11 is, you know, if you haven't thought about it before, think about it by 10 or 11. Sometimes it's difficult because the other adults will not help you. So I was recently with another one of my grandchildren in India, and he was very interested in a particular devotional project. Very interested. He was reading everything he could about it and studying about it, and we were going to that place. He said, Grandma, I'd really like to work with it. And when I contacted the person in charge, he's a 14-year-old boy, and he said, oh, we don't want any little children in the project. So this is, it's a big problem if you run into people who think like that.
Or if you hear a society that is not prepared.
Yeah.
Hmm? Or if you have society that is not prepared.
It makes it much more difficult. But that's one of the most important things. If you want your children to not only be devotees, but to be part of the society of devotees, then they need to see how they fit into that society. They need to have practical experience. It can't be just theory. They have to have practical experiences where they have skills and talents that are appreciated by the other devotees and where they're doing something that's important. So this should be looked at from as young an age as possible. And this is true for us too. It's true for the adults too. You know, each of us needs to experience that we have some important contribution to make to the society of devotees.
So if I understand correctly, one more thing that parents and other devotees should think about is how to form a community which will bring more options.
Absolutely.
To the children and everybody.
Absolutely. Absolutely. That's a society, international society for Krishna consciousness. And to think broadly about how we're going to spread Krishna consciousness. But, you know, whenever you have people who are preaching that devotees can only do a very narrow range of activities, they're crippling the development of our movement. You know, that the only thing devotees can do is prasadam distribution, book distribution, deity worship, shastra study, harinam, and anything else is maya. Then we can have ikkhan, but we can't have ISKCON.
ICON.
You can have international Krishna consciousness, but you cannot have ISKCON. ISKCON is International Society for Krishna Consciousness. In a society, people are going to be doing many, many things. Now, you can say the monks who live in ISKCON temples should only be doing those things. That's okay. But if you want to say the members of ISKCON who are working out in the world can only do those things, then we're never going to take over the world. We have to make Krishna... I mean, Bhaktivinoda Thakura said judges wearing, you know, high court judges wearing tilak. We want the doctors and the judges and the shopkeepers and the teachers and everybody to be wearing tilak. Okay, you can take one more. That would be it.
I thought she was doing this.
Anybody have anything else? Yes, please.
I have few times lectures for the children, and I feel that I have some clue for that.
Okay.
At least the other devotees are telling me. So I see that this is a huge field which is not exploited at all. To take care of kids on a proper way, like giving some classes or teach them something.
Yes.
So I wanted to know how much this helped you. Because when I listen your lectures now to elder devotees, it's so nicely explained that you can understand. So I think that this is also helping you because you are explaining to kids, which is
of course, even
more difficult to elders, you know.
Of course, it's a little different. The main difference is when you're explaining to children, you also have to discipline them. And they are not always there voluntarily. The children may be there because they have been told they have to be there. The adults are there because they want to be there. And the children are generally not so sense-controlled. So that's the main difference. So you have to be careful if you've been teaching children for a long time that you don't treat the adults like children. That's a danger. But yeah, I mean, from teaching children, well, it was interesting. I remember, you all know Broja Bihari, right?
I know.
Yeah.
You all know Broja Bihari. So he once said to me, he said, Urmila, you know so much about so many different subject matters. I said, well, that's because, you know, for 27 years, I was teaching primary and secondary school, and I was teaching history and geography and science and math and so many things. So I was having to read so many books and watch so many videos and science and geography, everything. But teaching is basically teaching. I mean, so if you... The system of being a teacher is not radically different. As I said, the main difference is the psychology of discipline is a little different, and motivation is a little different. So if I'm teaching children, I have to spend much more time and energy on motivation. Whereas like here, we advertise, it's a class on grihastha life. So if you come, I'm assuming you're already interested in grihastha. I don't have to make you interested. I don't have to motivate you to be interested. I figure if you walk in the door, you're already interested. Now, like this evening, they asked me to give a class, and that's for a general audience. There's no topic been announced. So then I'm going to have to work just as hard with whatever topic I choose to motivate people to want to hear what I have to say. Of course, many teachers of children don't learn that art either. Many teachers of children do not learn the art of motivation.
What I want is, can just here, I saw many times how many devotees are giving lectures, and when we are on the camps, those who organize the program, they just call some person who every day gives lecture, and he's the most popular, and he can give lecture to the children. And I saw how these lectures are totally not on the level of the children.
Mm.
And that's why I can notice that children don't have interest in that, because it is not teaching children, as you said, is... I can say it is much harder than teaching others. In a way that you have to find how to come to their heart and how to tell the things that they can accept.
Yes. It's definitely hard. Definitely hard. You have to add a whole element that you should also have when teaching adults, but it's not as essential. With teaching children, if you're going to be a good teacher of children, you must do that. Yes, that is a fact.
And also the groups, you cannot teach the 5 years old and 10 years old and 15 years old in the same way.
Well, but I mixed ages, always.
You mixed ages?
Always.
And you are giving the same way? Or you are just telling something and not now this is for you?
That's another 2-hour topic, which I cannot do now. Yes?
I will speak in Croatian.
Okay.
Imam tvoje djeca 3-5 godina, koji su jako su dobri, ali ponekad su vrlo nestašni. Pa možeš reći do koje mjere bi bila o disciplini, o primjerenoj kazni za da postavi još bolju vatke godine?
She has two children, 3 and 5 years old, and they are reluctantly to rebellious. Yeah, you know, like alive.
Like children.
Children, and so what should, when which, until what level should she try to,
I don't know what you mean by level, but there's many good methods of discipline that will help you to have your children be more willingly cooperative. I don't know what you mean by level. But discipline is a whole other topic. I mean, again, you're talking at least 1 to 2, maybe 3 hours. So that's... I don't want to cheat you and give you a 30-second answer for something that is not answerable in 30 seconds. But we will just say that there are many good methods of getting cooperation from children. None of them work absolutely because you're dealing with another living entity. You're not dealing with a machine. But there are many, many good methods that are going to be extremely effective with 3- and 5-year-old children. Okay, thank you.
Hare Krishna.
Hare Krishna.